warded man dropped from the horse's back and came over to him. Jake made no effort to rise or extend a hand, so he simply sat on the rock beside him.
The Jake I met on this hill would never break curfew.
Didn't have much choice. Knew you'd try and skulk off with the dawn.
Didn't Reagan's man bring you my letters?
Jake pulled out the bundle and threw it to the ground.
Can't read and you know it.
I came to see you in person. Wasn't expecting to find Mary there. And she wasn't eager that I stay.
I know. She came to me at the mill in tears. Told me everything.
I'm sorry.
You should be.
Jake sat quietly for a time, looking out over the land spread out before them.
Always knew she was just settling for me. You were gone a year before she saw me as anything more than a shoulder to cry on. Two more before she agreed to be my wife, and another after that before we made our vows. Even on the day, she was holding her breath, hoping you'd storm in and break up the ceremony. Night, I half expected it myself. Can't blame her. She was marrying down a class, and I ain't educated her much to look at. There was a reason I followed you around when we were kids. You were always better than me at everything. I wasn't even fit to be your jongleur.
Jake, I'm no better than you are.
Yeah, I see that now. I'm a better husband than you ever could have been. Know why? Because unlike you, I was there for her.
The warded man scowled, and any feelings of contrition fled from his thoughts. Anger and hurt he would accept from Jake, but the condescension in his tone burned.
That's the Jake I remember. Shows up and does the least he can. Heard Mary's dad had to call favors at the mill so you could afford to move off your parents' carpet.
But Jake stood fast.
I was there for her, here.
He pointed to his temple.
And here.
He pointed to his heart.
Your head and your heart were always out there. So why don't you just go back there? No one needs your delivering here.
The warden man nodded, leaping back up onto Twilight Dancer's back.
You take care of yourself, Jake.
The Demon Cycle, Book 2, The Desert Spear, Part 2, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2011, Peter V. Brett. All rights reserved. Recorded with the permission of the author. Production copyright 2012 by The Cutting Corporation, Incorporated. All rights reserved. With performances by Thomas Penny, Colleen Delaney, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Kimberly Gilbert, Alyssa Wilmoth, Bradley Smith, Eric Messner, Joe Brack, Nick DePinto, MJ Casey, Richard Rowan, James Konacek, Johan Detweiler, Christopher Graybill, Stephen Carpenter, Christopher Sheeran, Terrence Aselford, Ren Casey, Katie Karka, Nanette Savard, Karen Novak, Thomas Keegan, Daniel Sontag, Patrick Bussink, Lily Beacon, James Lewis, Drew Copus, Alexander Strain, and Mort Shelby. Adapted and directed by Johan Detweiler. Produced by Richard Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johan Detweiler. If you enjoyed The Demon Cycle, be sure to look for Brett Weeks' Night Angel Trilogy and Brandon Sanderson's Elantris and Warbreaker. Available now in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for previews of other exciting graphic audio material.
Graphic Audio presents Cotton Pickens.
You calling me a cheat?
Well, friend, the way you're dealing off the bottom with them pasteboards, it sure looks like it to me.
Why, you horse's ass!
who called himself Cotton. We know you're down there in that holler. Ain't nobody gonna hurt you. We got a proposition for you. That's all. That there was Jack Nolan you killed back yonder in the saloon. The other one was his partner. The fat one, named Larson. Both of them was gunslingers. You plenty fast, Mr. Cotton. Might be the man we want. You want a job?
I was still sort of not believing it when they handed me the badge. Sheriff of Puma County, Wyoming Territory. Notice, these rules go into effect right now. No shooting off guns in the town of Doubtful. No galloping horses in town. No horse racing in town. Now, I wouldn't hold it again none of you if you was all to quit, boys. You ain't getting paid enough to put your butts on the line. The way I see it, we're soon going to have more than 50 gunfighters in this valley. I aim to either stop this building up war in the valley or stand right in the middle of it shooting. You boys planning on starting a war all by yourselves?
Law won't do nothing. So I guess that leaves it up to us, right, Sheriff?
What you all have to do is get organized, get together. Little ranchers, farmers, sheepmen, you all gotta start pulling in double harness. You gotta start being real careful not to let none of these high-paid gun slicks pull you into trying to match them on the draw. I done all that a man could do, Preacher. But I'll add this. You're fixing to get a lot of good men killed in this valley if you don't back off this stupid plan of yours and break up this so-called army.
Nonsense! I shall lead my Christian army into the Valley of Death, and we shall emerge victorious, waving the banner of Christ!
Cotton!
Jack? What's on your mind?
Killing you!
You're crazy, Jack! Plum loco! We're brothers!
Don't make no difference!
You're lying, Jack. Who hired you to gun me?
Nobody, Cotton. And I'm telling you the truth. It's a business, Cotton. That's all it is. I'd kill Pa if he was around and got in my way.
Jack, don't draw on me. I'm better than you are, Jack.
No way, kid. See you in hell.
Cotton Pickens, Graphic Audio's newest Western hero, takes to the saddle in Cotton Pickens 1, Blood Valley.
Available now in Graphic Audio.
All hail Jill Kismet, the great pretender.
Graphic Audio presents Lilith St. Croix's
Jill Kismet.
They'll come for me, here or wherever I am, before dawn tomorrow. Meeting on the bridge is just a ploy. There's another game being played here, and I want to find out what it is before it gets any deeper. Or another hellbreed comes through to wipe my city off the map.
Book 5. Heaven's Spite.
And if it...
If it doesn't work, Anya, you will have to hunt me down. No pity, no mercy, no nothing. Kill me before I'm a danger to my city. Kill Perry, too. Burn him. Scatter the ashes as far as you can. Clear?
I got a knee in and wrestled him down as he twisted. Then he shot me. He shot me 4 times. I'm going to take care of it.
How the hell are you going to do that?
I've been playing Perry for years now.
If you didn't even know that he...
No matter what I knew or know or should have known, Mikiel's dead and my city's in danger. My best bet is getting that fucking hellbreed to a place where I can deal with him. With you and the Wares getting those evocation sites shut down, I have a chance of getting Saul out of this alive and my city another few days of rolling along.
Jill, you can't...
Do it, Anya. Now! I cut, the blade sliding in with little resistance. I sheared through whatever served him as stomach muscle. I finished with a twist. I brought my knee up. I heaved him away.
A Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents The Demon Cycle, Book 2, The Desert Spear, Part 3. Created by Peter V. Brett. Narrated by Dylan Lynch. With performances by Thomas Penny, Colleen Delaney, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Kimberly Gilbert, Alyssa Wilmoth, Bradley Smith, Eric Messner, Joe Brack, Nick DePinto, MJ Casey, Richard Rowan, James Konacek, Johan Detweiler, Christopher Graybill, Stephen Carpenter, Christopher Sheeran, Terrence Aselford, Ren Casey, Katie Karkoff, Nanette Savard, Karen Novak, Thomas Keegan, Daniel Sontag, Patrick Bussing, Lily Beacon, James Lewis, Drew Kopis, Alexander Strain, and Mort Shelby. The Desert Spear, Part 3.
Hey! Watch the bumps! I'm tuning!
Roger rode in the cart as it trundled along the road. He had carefully cleaned and waxed the ancient fiddle the warded man had given him, and purchased expensive new strings at the Jungler's Guild House. His old fiddle had belonged to Master Jacob, and the cheap workmanship had him forever tuning it. Before that, he had used Eric's fiddle, which was finer, though it had seen many years of use and was worn down even before Jason Goldentone and his apprentices smashed it. This one, rescued from forgotten ruin, was another class entirely. The neck and body curved differently than Roger was used to, but the workmanship was exquisite, and the wood had passed the centuries like days. A fiddle fit for a duke to play.
I'm sorry, Roger, but the road just doesn't seem to care that you're tuning. I don't know what's gotten into it.
Roger stuck his tongue out at Leisha, gently turning the last peg between the thumb and forefinger of his crippled hand, while the thumb of his other hand plucked at the string.
Got it! Stop the cart!
Roger, we have miles to go before dark.
Just for a minute.
Roger stood on the driver's seat, brandishing the fiddle and bow. He put the instrument under his chin.
Listen to that. Smooth like honey. Jacob's fiddle was a toy by comparison.
If you say so, Roger.
Roger frowned for a moment, then dismissed her with a wave of his bow. He could feel Eric's medallion resting comfortably against his bare chest, hidden under his motley tunic. No longer a trigger to painful memories, it was a reassuring weight. A way to honor those who had died for him. He stood straighter, knowing it was there. This wasn't the first talisman Roger had carried. For years, he had kept a puppet of wood and string topped with a lock of his master's golden hair in a secret pocket in the waistband of his motley pants. Before that, it was a puppet of his mother, capped with a lock of her red hair. But with the medallion, Roger could feel both Eric and his parents looking over him, and he spoke to them through the fiddle. He played his love and played his loneliness and regret. He told them all the things he had never been able to in life. When he finally finished, Leisha and the others were staring at him, their eyes glazed like charmed corlings.
I ain't never heard anything beautiful as that.
Leisha produced a handkerchief, dabbing at her eyes. The rest of the journey to Deliverer's Hollow was filled with music, with Roger playing every minute his hands weren't otherwise occupied. He knew they were returning to all the same problems they had left, but with the promise of aid to come from the Duke and the Jungler's Guild, as well as the comfort of the medallion around his neck, he held new hope that all their problems could be solved. They were still a day away from the Hollow when the way became choked with refugees, many of them with tents and warding circles pitched right in the road. Leisha knew them immediately as Lactonians, for as a whole they were stocky folk, short and round-faced, and they stood as those more used to walking on a boat's deck than dry land.
What's happened?
Leisha spoke to the first person they came to, a young mother. The woman looked at her with hollow, uncomprehending eyes as Leisha got down from the cart.
The Krasians.
Creator! Have they marched on Lacton so soon?
No. They've spread out through Ryzen's hamlets, forcing the women to cover up and dragging the men off to fight demons. They pick and choose Ryzonian girls to take as wives like a rancher picking a chicken to slaughter, and march the boys to training camps where they're taught to hate their own families.
Leisha scowled.
Hamlets ain't safe anymore. Those that could moved on to Lacton proper, and a few stayed to fight for their homes, but the rest of us went to the Hollow looking for the Deliverer. He wasn't there, but folks said he had gone on to Angiers, so that's where we're headed. He'll put things right. You see if he doesn't.
So we all hope.
Leisha climbed back into the cart.
We need to get to the Hollow immediately.
She looked at Garrod.
Clear the road!
The folk fell over themselves to move out of his path. Tents, blankets, and wards were snatched quickly away. Leisha regretted the need, but the cart could not go off-road, and her children needed her. They galloped the horses when they finally cleared the press of refugees, thousands in number, but they were still well short of the Hollow by nightfall. It only took a mild look from Leisha to make Roger take up his fiddle, and they rode on through the darkness with only Leisha's light staff to guide them and his music to keep the corlings at bay. Leisha could see the demons at the edge of the light, swaying in time to the music as they ambled slowly after Roger, mesmerized.
I'd rather they were attacking.
Wanda had her great bow strung and a warded arrow knocked and ready.
That ain't natural.
They made it to Leisha's cottage on the outskirts of the Hollow by midnight and paused only long enough for Leisha to store the most precious of their cargo before they pressed on through the darkness to the village proper. If things had seemed cramped before, they were many times worse now. The refugees from Lacton came better equipped, with tents and warding circles and covered wagons laden with supply, but they spilled over the edges of the forbidding on almost every side, weakening the great ward. Leisha turned to Garrod and Wanda.
Find the other cutters and make a sweep of the forbidden. Any tent or carriage within 10 feet of the great ward needs to be moved, or we could have Corlins in the streets.
The two nodded and moved off. She turned to Roger.
Find Smit and Jonah. I want a council meeting tonight. I don't care who's in bed.
I don't have to ask where you'll be, I suppose.
Roger hopped from the cart and pulled up the hood of his warded cloak as she turned the cart for the hospit. Jardir looked up as Avan limped into the throne room.
You seem almost spry today, Kafit.
The spring air gives me strength, Shardamaka.
Ashan was at Jardir's side. Jayan and Asom kept their distance, having learned not to antagonize Avan in their father's presence.
What do you know of the place called Deliverer's Hollow?
You seek the warded man.
Ashan lunged at Avan, taking him by the throat.
Where did you hear the name, Kafit? If you've been bribing the Nidama for information again, I...
Ashan, enough!
When the Damaji did not comply fast enough, Jardir did not ask again, kicking him hard in the side.
You would strike me, your loyal Damaji, over a pig-eating Kafit!
I struck you for not attending my command.
Jardir swept his gaze over the rest of those in the room. Alaveric and Maji, Jayan and Asom, Ashan, Hasik, even the door guards. Only a Nevra, stretched out in her diaphanous robes on a bed of bright silk pillows beside his throne, escaped his gaze.
I tire of this game. So I say now for all to hear, I will kill the next person to strike someone in my presence when I have not given them leave to do so.
Aban began to smirk, but Jardir whirled on him, glaring.
And you, Kafit, the next time you answer a question with a question, I will tear out your right eye and make you eat it. How did you learn of the one they call the Warded Man? The Dama required intensive interrogation to pull his name from the Chin holy men's lips.
It's all the Chin talk about, Deliverer. I doubt the interrogations discovered anything a few crumbs of bread or words of kindness couldn't have gathered freely on the street.
And the stories agree he is in the village called Deliverer's Hollow.
Yes.
What do you know of it?
Until a year ago, it was called Cutter's Hollow, a small village of men beholden to the Duke of Angiers, who felled trees for lumber and fuel. Wood is impractical to ship through the desert, so I had little business with them. Though I do have one contact who might remain, a seller of fine paper.
What good is that?
I do not know that it is, Damaji.
And what have you heard of this place since its name changed?
That the Warded Man came to them last year when the village was rife with flux and the wards failing. That he killed hundreds of Alagai with his bare hands alone and taught the villagers to fight Alagai Sharak.
Impossible. The Chin are too weak and cowardly to stand up in the night.
Perhaps not all remember the Parchin.
No one remembers the Parchin, Kafit. You would do well not to remember him either.
Baba nodded, bowing as low as his crutch would allow.
I will see for myself, and you will come with me. Hasik, find Shanjat. Tell him to assemble the spears of the Deliverer.
Jardir's maize unit had taken the name when they became his personal bodyguard. The spears of the Deliverer were 50 of the finest Dalsharim in Krasia, serving under Kai Sharam Shanjat. Hasik bowed, leaving immediately.
Are you certain this is wise, Deliverer? It is not safe to separate yourself from your armies in enemy lands.
Nothing in life is safe for those who fight Sharaka. But if you are concerned, you may come with me, my friend.
Ashan bowed deeply.
This is foolishness. 1,000 weakling Jinn can overwhelm even the spears of the Deliverer.
I doubt that very much, old man.
Alaveric turned to Jardir, who nodded his permission. The ancient Damaji reached out to Jayan, and suddenly the boy was on his back.
I'll kill you for that, old man!
Try it, boy.
By all means, try and kill him.
A vicious smile broke out on Jayan's face, but a moment later he was back on the floor. Alaverac was pulling on his arm to increase the slow pressure of his heel on Jayan's windpipe.
Enough! Even my own sons must respect the Damaji, Jayan. You would be wise to hold your tongue in the future. The Damaji will rule Evrim's bounty in my absence, with you leading the council.
Alaverac narrowed his eyes as if deciding whether or not to continue his protest. Finally, he bowed deeply.
As the Shah Damaka commands, who will speak for the Kaji until Damaji Ashan returns?
My son, Dama Asukaji.
Ashan nodded to the young man. Asukaji was not yet 18, but he was old enough for the white robe, which meant he was old enough for the black turban, if he was strong enough to hold it.
And if Jayan will be humble, he will serve as Sharum Ka.
All eyes turned to Jayan, whose face betrayed his shock. After a moment, he put one hand and one knee on the ground, perhaps for the first time in his life.
I will serve the council of Damaji, of course.
See to it the lesser tribes continue to subjugate the Chin while I am gone.
He turned to Asukaji and Alaverac.
I need fresh warriors for Sharaka, not bickering tribes stealing one another's wells.
Inevera rose from her bed of pillows, her face serene behind the diaphanous veil.
I would speak to my husband in private.
Of course, Damaja.
Ashan ushered the others quickly out of the room, all save Asom, who stood fast behind.
Something troubles you, my son?
If Jayan is to be Sharam Ka while you are gone, then, by rights, I should be Andra.
Asom's eyes narrowed, but he knew better than to cross her.
That would put you above your elder brother, my son. Something no father does lightly. And Sharam Ka are appointed. Andra is a title that must be earned.
Summon the Damaji. I will kill them all if that is what is required.
Shardir looked into his son's eyes, seeing ambition, but also a fierce pride that might indeed carry the boy, barely past his 18th born day, through 11 death challenges, even if it meant killing one of his own brothers or Asukaji, who was his closest friend and rumored to be his lover. Asom's white robe might forbid him to touch a weapon, but he was deadlier than Jayan by far, and even a Leverak would do well to step carefully around him. Shardir felt a swell of pride in the boy. Already he thought his second son might well prove a better successor than Jayan, but not until he was seasoned, and firstborn Jayan would never allow his brother to surpass him while he still drew breath.
Krasia needs no Andra while I live, and Jayan will only wear the white turban while I am gone. You will assist Asukaji in maintaining control of the Kaji.
But I...
Enough! The matter is closed. Leave us.
Asom scowled, but he bowed and left.
He will be a great leader one day, if he lives long enough.
I often think the same of you, husband. Eleverak and the Shan were right. There is no need for you to lead the expedition personally.
Is it not the duty of the Shardamakar to gather armies to Sharaka? By all accounts, these Chin fight the Holy War. I must investigate.
You could at least have waited until I had a chance to throw the dice.
There's no need to throw the dice every time I leave the palace.
Perhaps there is. Sharaka is no game. We must command every advantage if we are to succeed.
If Evrim wills me to succeed, that is all the advantage I need.
And if he does not?
Anevra lifted her felt pouch of Alagai Hora.
Pray, indulge me.
Shardir nodded, and they retreated to a chamber off the throne room that Anevra had claimed as her own. As always, the room was filled with bright pillows and cloying incense. Shardir felt his pulse quicken, his body conditioned to associate the smell with Anevra's sex. The Jiwa Ka was more than happy to share him when she was sated, but she was almost a man in her hunger, and the side chamber was used frequently for that purpose, often while the Damaji and Jardir's counselors waited in the throne room without. Anevra moved to pull the curtains, and he watched her body through the translucent veils that were all she ever wore anymore. Even at more than 40 years of age, she never said for certain. She was the most beautiful of his wives by far, her curves still round and firm, her skin smooth. He was tempted to take her right there, but Anevra was single-minded when the dice were concerned, and he knew she would only rebuff him until they were thrown. They knelt on the silk pillows, allowing a broad space for the dice to fall. As always, Anevra needed his blood for the spell, releasing it with a quick slash of her warded knife. She licked the blade clean and returned it to her belt sheath, pressing her palm to the wound and then emptying the dice into it. They glowed fiercely in the dark as she shook her hands and threw. The demon bones scattered on the floor, and Anevra scanned them quickly. Shardir had learned that the pattern of the fall was as important as the symbols that showed, but his understanding of the dice ended there. He had seen his wives argue many times over the meaning of a throw, though none ever dared question Anevra's interpretations.
You cannot go.
Cannot?
Shardir pulled the heavy drapes aside, flooding the room with bright sunlight. Anevra barely got her dice back in the pouch in time.
I am Shardamakar. There is nothing I cannot do.
The dice promise disaster if you go.
I tire of following your dice, especially since they always seem to tell you more than you deem me worthy to know. I will go.
Then I am going with you.
You will do no such thing. You will stay here and keep your sons from killing one another until I return.
He strode up to her and took her shoulder in a firm grip.
I would have one last taste of my wife, though, before the trek north.
Anevra twisted, seeming only to tap his arm, but his grip lost strength for an instant, and she stepped away.
If you go alone, you can wait. More reason to come back alive.
Shardir scowled, but he knew better than to try to force the issue. Shardamakar and husband or no. Wanda opened the door to Leisha's cottage, letting Roger and Garrett in. Once the girl heard the warded man had commanded Garrett to guard Roger, she had insisted on doing the same for Leisha, sleeping at the cottage every night. Leisha had begun assigning her chores to try to dissuade the girl's smothering, but Wanda did the work gladly, and Leisha had to admit she had grown accustomed to her looming presence.
The cutters finished felling trees to clear space for the next great word. It's a mile square, just like you asked.
That's good.
We can start laying stones to mark the edges of the ward immediately.
Land's thick with woodies. Hundreds of them. The cotton droom like flies to a dung pile. You ought to gather the town and wipe them out before we build.
He's right. The demons will be pushed to its edges when the ward activates, making them thicker still, ready to kill anyone who stumbles off the forbidding. We should just annihilate them in the open rather than try to hunt them through the trees later.
It's what the warded man would do.
The warded man would do half the killing himself, but he's not here.
That's why we need your help. Gonna need thundersticks and liquid demon fire. Lots of it.
I see.
No, you're busy. I got folk to do the mixing if you give them the recipe.
You want me to give you the secrets of fire? I would sooner let the knowledge pass from the world.
What's the difference between that and my warded axe? You trust folks with one, not the other?
The difference is that your axe doesn't explode and destroy everything within 50 feet if you drop it or leave it out in the sun. My own apprentices will be lucky if I teach them the secrets of fire one day.
So we should build a refugee town on demon-infested land?
It's gonna be an extension of the Hollow, not a refugee town. And of course not! Draw up a plan, and if it's sound, I'll make what's needed. But I'll be on hand to make sure no wood-brained idiot sets himself or the Ripping Woods on fire.
Ain't safe. Need you at the hospital in case anyone's hurt.
Then you'll be fighting without the flamework.
Ain't no demon gonna lay a claw on Mistress Leisha while I'm around, Garrett Cutter. And I don't mean to wait at the hospital either.
We'll scour in a week. Plenty of time to prepare the land and mix the chemics. Let Ben know as well. Might as well let the demons charge some glass before we show them the sun.
They galloped across the land on black desert chargers, 50 warriors following Jardir and Ashan on their white stallions. Trailing behind, but keeping them in sight, if barely, came Aban on his long-legged camel. They were forced to stop several times to allow him to catch up, usually by a stream where they could water their horses. Such things were almost commonplace in the Greenlands, something that never ceased to amaze the desert warriors. They encountered some Greenland refugees on the road, but these fled their path, and Jardir saw no gain in pursuing them. On foot and afraid to travel at night, there was little danger of them getting ahead and warning the Hollow, and none of them would dare attack the spears of the Deliverer. Even the Corlings at night shied from their path, for Jardir did not call halt when the sun set. Aban somehow managed to keep up in the night, though. He put his camel right in the center of the warriors, tolerating their jeers and spittle for the succor they offered. It was on such a night that they came upon the Hollow. They slowed their pace, and Jardir turned into the trees to follow the cacophony, his warriors following. Eventually, they came to the edge of a great swath of cleared land filled with the stumps of trees where the Chin fought their northern Alagai Sharak. Great fires blazed in trenches, and coupled with the constant flare of wards throughout the battlefield, the clearing was lit as if it were daylight and littered with dead Alagai. The fires and wards funneled demons into places where the northerners stood ready to cut them to pieces.
They've prepared the battlefield.
Unlike the Chin from Everon's Bounty, these northerners were tall and heavily muscled. The largest of them fought not with spear and shield, but with great warded axes and mattocks. The men were of a size with the wood demons and chopped at them like trees. The northerners fought well, but there were hundreds of wood demons coming at them. It seemed the Chin would be overwhelmed when they broke apart, clearing ground for a line of archers to scour the field. Jardir gaped to see the archers were clad in the long dresses the northern women favored, displaying their faces and half their breasts like harlots.
They're women joining Alagai Sharak!
Jardir looked closer at the battlefield and saw that even some of those fighting in close quarters were female. And there was a great giant even among these tall people who led every charge. He swung a great two-headed axe in one hand like a hatchet, and in the other he swung a machete as if it were a pocket knife. One of the northerners went down on one knee at the blow of an 8-foot-tall wood demon, and the giant tackled it away before it could land a killing blow. He lost his weapons in the tumble, but it made no difference as the Alagai leapt at him. With one hand, the giant stopped the demon short, grabbing it, and with the other, he landed a blow that flared with magic and sent the Alagai reeling. Jardir saw he wore heavy gloves banded with warded metal. The giant gave the wood demon no time to recover, falling on it and pummeling it about the head until he was covered in ichor and the demon lay still. Another demon approached, but a slender boy with bright red hair and pale skin, dressed like a kafit in a patchwork of bright color, stood before it and put up an instrument of some sort.
Hevram's beard! What magic does that one carry?
We must find out.
Allow me to kill the giant and bring the boy to you, Deliverer.
Hasika's eyes took on the mad light they always did before battle.
Do nothing. We are here to learn, not fight.
Suddenly, two other figures caught Jadir's eye. One was clearly a woman, carrying no weapon, only a small basket. The other was much larger and dressed like a man, but carried a bow like the northern women. Her face was demon-scarred. Both were clad in fine cloaks embroidered with hundreds of wards, and they wandered through the carnage unmolested by Alagai and given a respectful berth by the other northerners.
They are unseen to the Alagai, as if they were wearing the cloak of Kaji.
A demon clawed through the chest of a man. The cloaked woman hurried to the man, the taller one putting an arrow in the demon as the slender one knelt by the man's side. She pulled back her hood, and Jadir saw her face. She was even more beautiful than Anevera, her skin white like cream, a sharp contrast with her hair, black like the armor of a rock demon. The woman tore the man's shirt, tending his wound while her female bodyguard stood watch over her, shooting any Alagai that dared draw close.
Some sort of northern Damating?
A heathen parody of one, perhaps.
After a moment, the beautiful woman gave a command to her bodyguard, who slung her bow across her shoulders and lifted the wounded man in her arms. The way back out was blocked by a group of Alagai, but the northern Damating reached into her pouch and removed an object. Fire appeared in her hand, setting spark to it, and she drew back her arm and threw.
Heathen, perhaps, but these northerners are not without power.
The men must be cowards, worse than kafit, to depend on women for their rescue. I would rather die on the field.
No, Shanjat. The cowards are us, hiding here in the shadows while Chin fight Alagai Sharak.
They are our enemies.
Perhaps by day, but all men are brothers in the night.
Jadir put up his night veil and lifted his spear. Yeah! Roger looked up in surprise. Dozens of black-clad Krasian warriors were charging into the clearing, brandishing spears. His blood went cold, and the bow slipped from his fiddle. A demon almost killed him in that moment, but Garrett cut the arm that swiped at him clean off with his machete.
Eyes on the demons! Krasians ain't gonna fight if we let the Korans do the work for them!
But it quickly became apparent that the Krasians had no intention of attacking the Hollowers. Led by a man with a white turban and a warded spear that looked as if it was made entirely of polished silver, they fell upon the wood demons like a pack of wolves breaking into a chicken coop, killing with practiced efficiency. Roger and the others had assumed the scouring would take all night and planned for reserves of fighters to be brought in as needed and much of Leisha's flamework used. With the Krasians fighting, the battle was over in minutes. Krasian and Greenlander alike stood frozen when the last demon fell, staring at one another in shock. All continued to clutch their weapons as if unsure the time for battle was past, but none dared make the first move, waiting for word from their leaders.
The Chin watch us with one eye.
Hashan nodded.
The other eye looks to the giant and the red-haired kafit boy who made the Alagai run in terror.
They stand as frozen as the others.
Not the true leaders, then. Kai Sharam or the heathen equivalent. The giant might even be the Shom Kai.
Men still worthy of respect, then. Come.
Jadir strode over to the two, slipping his spear into his shoulder harness and showing his hands to indicate he meant no harm. When he stood before the men, he dipped a polite bow.
I am Aman, son of Hoshkamin, of the line of Jadir, son of Kaji. This is Damaji Ashan.
Honored.
The two Greenlanders looked at each other curiously. Finally, the red-haired boy shrugged and the giant relaxed. Jadir realized with surprise that the boy was dominant.
Roger, son of Jessam, of the Inns of Riverbridge.
Garrett Cutter, son of Steve.
Ashan spoke to Jardir in their native Krasian.
Shar Damaka, more Chin approach. One of their heretic clerics and the heathen healer.
I've no wish to antagonize these people, Ashan. Heathens or no, we will respect them as if they were Dama and Damating.
And shall I wash the feet of their kafit as well?
If I command it.
Jardir bowed deeply to the new arrivals. The red-haired boy stepped in smoothly to facilitate the introductions. Jardir met the holy man, bowed, and forgot his name instantly, turning to the woman.
Mistress Leisha Paper, herb gatherer of Deliverer's Hollow.
On impulse, Jardir took her hand and kissed it. He knew it was bold, especially among strangers, but Everum favored the bold, it was said.
Thank you for your assistance.
All men are as brothers in the night. We stand united.
And during the day?
I believe all people should stand united in the day as well.
United under you.
Jardir felt Ashan and the Greenland men tense. It was as if no one else on the scene mattered. Only they two would determine if the black demon Ikor on the field of battle would soon be covered with red human blood. But Jardir had no fear of that, feeling as if this meeting was destined long ago. He spread his hands helplessly.
If it is Evram's will, perhaps someday.
You're honest, at least. Perhaps it's best, then, that the knight is young. Will you and your counselor share tea with us?
We would be honored. May my warriors pitch horses and tents in this clearing while they wait?
At the far end. We have work yet to do on this side.
Jardir looked at her curiously, and then noted the Greenlanders who had come out after the battle was complete. These were smaller, weaker men than the axe-wielding warriors, and they began gathering glittering objects off the battlefield.
What are they about?
Leisha looked to the side, then bent to retrieve a stoppered glass bottle, which she handed to Jardir. It was an elegant blow of glass, beautiful in its simplicity.
Smash it with the butt of your spear.
Jardir's brow furrowed at that, not understanding the significance of destroying something so beautiful. Perhaps it was some sort of friendship ritual. He pulled free the spear of Kaji and complied with her request, but the butt of the spear ricocheted off the bottle, leaving the glass intact.
Evram's beard. Incredible.
Warded glass.
Leisha picked the bottle back up and gave it to him.
Our peoples could learn much from each other, if we keep peace by day as well as night.
I agree. Let us discuss that, among other things, at our tea.
Did you see his crown?
And his metal spear. He's the one Merrick and the warded man we're talking about.
Obviously. I meant the crown itself. The warded man has the same wards on his own forehead.
Really?
I don't think Arlen told us everything he knows about that man.
Can't believe you invited him to tea.
Should I have spat in his eye instead?
Or had me shoot him? He's killed half the men in Rising and had his men force themselves on every flowered woman in the duchy.
Wanda stopped short, then turned to Leisha suddenly, leaning in close.
You're gonna drug him, aren't you? Take him and his men prisoner?
I'm gonna do no such thing. Everything we know about that man is hearsay. All we know for sure is that he and his men helped us fight off 200 wood demons. He's our guest until his actions show he should be treated otherwise.
Not to mention that kidnapping their deliverer is the surest way under the sun to bring the Krasian army straight down on the hollow.
There's that as well. Ask Smit to clear his tap room and summon the town council. Let everyone see and judge this supposed demon of the desert for themselves.
He's not what I expected at all.
Polite-like.
Garrett agreed with Tender Jonah.
All false-faced. Like the servants in the Duke's palace.
It's called manners, Garrod. You and the other men could use a few lessons in them yourselves.
He has a point. I expected a monster, not some royal smiling through his oiled beard.
I know what you mean. I certainly didn't expect him to be so handsome.
Jonah, Roger, and Garrod all stopped short. Leisha walked several more steps before she noticed they were not keeping pace. She looked back to find the men staring at her. Even Wanda had a surprised look on her face.
What?
We're just going to pretend you didn't say that.
These Greenlanders are worse than we thought.
Ashan spoke as they walked back to join the other men.
I cannot believe they take orders from a woman.
But what a woman. Powerful and exotic and beautiful as the dawn.
She dresses like a harlot. You should have killed her simply for daring to meet your eyes.
It is death to kill a Damating.
Your pardon, Shah Damaka. But she is not a Damating. She is a heathen. All these Greenlanders are infidel, praying to a false god.
They follow Evrim whether they know it or not. There are only two divine laws in the Avija. Worship one god and dance Alagai Sharok. Beyond that, every tribe is entitled to their own customs. Perhaps these Greenlanders are not so different from us. Perhaps their customs are simply foreign to us.
Ashan opened his mouth to protest, but a look from Jardir made it clear the discussion was over. Ashan's mouth snapped shut, and he bowed.
Of course. If the Shah Damaka says it, it must be so.
Go and tell the Darsharam to make camp. You, Hasik, Shanjat, and Aban will join me for their tea.
We're bringing the Kafit? He is not worthy to take tea with men.
He is more fluent in their tongue than you are, my friend. And Hasik and Shanjat barely have a handful of Greenland words between them. This is the very reason I chose to bring him. He will prove invaluable at this meeting.
It seemed the whole town had gathered around Smith's tavern by the time the Krasians arrived. Leisha let only the town council and their spouses attend, but coupled with Smith's small army of children and grandchildren who were setting and serving, they outnumbered the Krasians greatly.
You're right. Oh, he is handsome.
Leisha turned to Ilona in surprise.
Who told you I said that?
Ilona only smiled.
Welcome.
Jardir made it to the door. She and her mother gave identical curtsies. Jardir looked at Ilona, then glanced over to Leisha. They were similar enough that no one could mistake their relation.
Your sister?
My mother, Ilona.
Leisha rolled her eyes and allowed Jardir to kiss her hand.
And my father, Ernol.
Jardir bowed to him.
Allow me to introduce my counselors.
Jardir gestured to the men behind him.
You have met Damaji Ashan. These are Kai Sharam Shanjat and my Dalsharam bodyguard, Hasik.
The men bowed with the introduction. Jardir made no effort to introduce the fifth member of his entourage, moving on down the receiving line with his men, bowing and making introductions. The fifth was unlike any of the others. Where they were lean, he was fat. Where they dressed in somber, solid colors, he was clad as brightly as any jongleur. And where they were fit and strong, he leaned on his crutch so heavily that it seemed he would fall over without it. Leisha opened her mouth to greet the man as he entered, but his eyes passed over her, and he bowed to her father.
A pleasure to meet you at last, Ernol Paper.
Do I know you?
Aban Haman Amkaji.
I used to sell you paper. I, actually still have your last order sitting in my shop. I was waiting on payment when the messenger stopped coming from Risen.
600 sheets of your daughter's flower press, I believe.
Nat, that was you? Do you know how many hours I slaved over those sheets, only to have them sitting in the dry house like compost?
Jardir was there in an instant, breaking away from an introduction to Smith as if it were meaningless.
What have you said to offend our host, Kafit?
Aban bowed as low as his crutch would allow.
It seems I owe her father some money, deliverer, for paper she and her father made for me years ago that I was not able to claim after our borders closed.
Jardir backhanded him viciously to the ground.
You will pay him triple what you owe immediately.
Leisha shoved Jardir aside, running to Aban's side and kneeling beside him. He tried to pull away, but she took his head firmly in her hands, examining him. His lip was split, but she didn't think it would require stitching. She rose quickly and glared at Jardir.
Just what in the core is the matter with you?
He is only Kafit, a weakling without honor.
I don't care what he is. He is a guest under our roof, as are you. And if you wish to remain so, you'll mind your ripping manners and keep your hands to yourself.
Jardir stood there, stunned, and his counselors looked equally shocked. All turned to their leader for a cue on how to react. The warriors flexed their hands as if readying them to reach for the short spear slung over their shoulders, and Leisha's fingers itched to reach into one of the many pockets of her apron for a handful of blinding powder in case they did. But Jardir broke the stare and stepped back, bowing deeply.
You are right, of course. I apologize for bringing violence to your table.
Jardir turned to Aban.
I will purchase the pages from you at triple what you must pay her father. Anything so precious to Mistress Leisha must be a treasure indeed.
Aban touched his forehead to the floor and then braced himself on his cane to rise. Ernie rushed over to help him, though the small man could do little to shift the other's great bulk. Jadir turned and smiled at Lisha, beaming with pride as if he honestly thought he could impress her any more with a display of wealth than he had with one of violence.
Handsome or no, he's a pompous ass.
Perhaps, but an ass who can crush the hollow like a bug if he wishes.
Don't go betting on that.
With that, the Krasians were ushered to one of the tall Greenland tables with its hard benches in Smith's Tavern. Tea was served by children, along with plates of hard biscuit.
I'm sorry we can't offer you better fare, but depredations of war have been hard on our village. With thousands of refugees having senselessly lost everything they own, and many loved ones as well.
I am told your village was small and little different from any other a year ago, and yet now you are large and powerful. I see no hungry on your streets, no beggars or wailers or cripples. Instead, you stand tall in the night, fighting demons by the hundred. Like steel, my coming has tempered your village and made it stronger.
Weren't you that tempered it? More did man done that, back when you were still eating sand out in the desert.
I would know more of this warded man. I have heard much of him in Evrim's Bounty, but nothing from one who had actually seen the man.
He's a deliverer. That's all you need to know. Gave us back the magic we lost all them years ago.
Combat wards to fight the Allegai.
That's right.
May I see a weapon he has warded?
Garrett hesitated, his eyes flicking over to Lisha. Jardir's naturally followed, and again her blue eyes, like cool water, threatened to drown him in their hidden depths. She smiled, and a thrill went through him.
We'll show you, if you'll show us some of yours. Your spear, perhaps?
Ashan again spoke in Krasian.
Deliverer, no! The spear of Kaji is unfit for the hands of a djinn.
It is no longer the spear of Kaji, Ashan. It is the spear of Aman, and I will do with it as I please. It will not be the first time it had been touched by djinn hands, and its blessings remain.
What if they try to steal it?
Jadir looked at Hasik, his eyes calm.
If they try, we will kill every man, woman, and child in this village and raze it to the ground.
The matter closed, he lifted the spear horizontally before him. In response, Garrod reached to his belt, pulling free a long blade. Hasik and Shanjat tensed, ready to strike, but the giant flipped the weapon over, holding the blade to offer Jardir the hilt. As one, they switched. There was no pretense of decorum then, as those skilled in warding on both sides rushed to examine the weapons. Jardir turned the long blade over to catch the light as it ran in glittering rivers along the intricate wards etched in its surface. He saw immediately that most of the wards were the same his people used to ward their own weapons, symbols taken from the spear of Kaji, which held almost every combat ward in existence. But the warding went beyond cold functionality, like the harshly etched spears of the Dal Sharam. There was an artistry to it that rivaled anything Jardir had ever seen outside the spear itself. Hundreds of wards flowing in harmony to weave a net of incredible power that was both beautiful to look upon and terrible for an Allegai to behold.
Oh, exquisite.
Priceless. Could this warded man have stolen the symbols from Anak-San?
Ridiculous. No one has been there in 1,000 years, except...
Jardir looked at his men, and all eyes had lit with the same thought.
No, he is dead.
Of course. It must be so.
They looked up to see Lisha and her father, now wearing spectacles, examining the spear of Kaji a little too closely. They had held it long enough to appreciate the grandeur, but he saw no reason to give away all its secrets yet.
These wards are strong.
Jardir presented the blade back out to Garrod, handle first. He looked pointedly at the spear, and the Greenlanders grudgingly returned it. The look of longing in Leisha's eyes as the spear was returned was gratifying. She was hungry for its secrets.
Where is this warded man? I would very much like to meet him.
He comes and goes.
Was it he that gave you your wondrous cloak? Truly, it is like the robe of Kaji himself, to let you walk past Allegai unseen.
Leisha's cheeks colored, and Jardir realized he had just complimented her in some way.
The cloaks of Unsight are my own creation. I altered wards of confusion and sight, along with a mild forbiddance, so that no Coraline, big or small, can see one wearing it.
Incredible. Evra must speak in your ear if you are altering wards, especially to make something of such divine beauty and power.
Leisha looked down at her cloak, fingering it absently. Finally, she got to her feet, unfastening the silver ward clasp at her throat.
Take it.
Are you crazed?
Ilona moved to block her way.
The cloak's only good against demons. Take it, to remind you who the real enemy is when the sun rises tomorrow.
Jardir put his hands flat on the tabletop and bowed.
That is too great a gift, and I have nothing to give in return. By Evrim, I cannot accept.
The reminder is all I want in return.
Jardir bowed again, taking the wondrous cloak with widening eyes. If the wards on this so-called warded man's weapon were a harmony, Leisha's cloak of unsight was a symphony. He folded the cloak carefully and tucked it in his robe before he or any of his counselors began to study the gift to distraction.
Thank you, Mistress Leisha, daughter of Erny, herb-gatherer of Deliverer's Hollow. You honor me greatly with your gift.
Leisha smiled and returned to her seat. For a moment, the Greenlanders made a great pretense of sipping their tea, murmuring to one another as they did. Jardir allowed them this conference time, looking to Aban. Jardir spoke to Aban in his native tongue.
Tell me of the red-haired boy who dresses like a kafit.
He is what the Greenlanders call a jungler deliverer. They are traveling storytellers and music makers who dress in bright colors to announce their craft. It is considered an honored profession, and its practitioners are often highly regarded figures of inspiration.
He had power over the Alagai with his music, commanded them with it. What of that?
The tales of the warded man speak of such a one, who charms Alagai with his magic, but I know nothing of this power. It is not common, I imagine.
Roger watched uneasily as the Krasians cast furtive glances his way. It was obvious they were talking about him, but while Roger's trained ear had already begun to isolate the sounds and patterns of their surprisingly musical tongue, understanding was still far off. Jardir glanced his way again, and before Roger could avert his eyes, their eyes met. Roger started, feeling like a cornered hare.
Forgive me, we have been impolite.
Roger pretended to scratch his chest, but it was just an excuse to touch his talisman. He drew strength both from the medallion and the reassuring presence of Garrod at his side. Not for the first time, Roger was glad for the mighty woodcutter's oath to keep him protected.
No offense taken.
There are no junglers among my people. Your profession interests us.
You don't have musicians?
We do, but in Krasia, music is used only to praise Evrim, not to charm demons on the battlefield. Tell me, is this power common in the North?
Not in the least. I can't even teach it. I don't quite know how I do it myself.
Perhaps Evrim speaks to you. Perhaps he has blessed your line with this power. Have any of your sons shown promise?
Sons? I'm not even married.
A man of your power should have many brides to bear him sons.
Agreed. I should have many brides.
I'd like to see you handle one.
Roger looked at Jardir only to find that the Krasian leader was not among those laughing.
May I ask you a personal question, son of Jessam?
Roger touched the medallion at his father's name, but he nodded.
How did you get that scar?
Jardir pointed at the crippled hand Roger had raised, missing two fingers and part of the palm besides.
It looks old, too old for you to have gotten it fighting Alagai as a man. And it hinders you little, as if you've had it many years.
Roger felt his blood run cold. His eyes flicked to the fat merchant prince in his bright silks, treated with such derision by his fellows because he was crippled. He wondered if the Krasians thought him much less a man for having only half a hand. Everyone else had stopped talking, waiting on Roger's answer. They had all been half listening anyway, but now everyone stared at them openly. Roger scowled.
Are the Hollowers so different?
None of them, not even Leisha, had ever so much as mentioned his crippled hand, trying to pretend it didn't exist, and then staring when they thought he wasn't watching.
Demons broke through our wards when I was a child of three. My father stood with an iron fireplace poker to hold them off while my mother fled with me. A flame demon leapt upon her back, biting through my hand and into her shoulder.
How did you survive this? Did your father save you?
My father was dead by then. My mother killed the flame demon and pushed me into a bolt hole.
Your mother killed a flame demon?
P- pulled it off me and drowned it in a water trough. The water boiled and left her arms blistered and red by the time its thrashing stopped.
Oh, Roger. How terrible. You never told me any of that.
You never asked. No one's ever asked me about my hand before. Everyone, even you, avoids it with their eyes.
I always thought you wanted privacy. I didn't want to make you uncomfortable by calling attention to your...
deformity?
Jardir stood sharply, his face enraged. Everyone on both sides of the table tensed, ready in an instant to fight or flee.
That is an Alagai scar.
Jardir reached across the table and grabbed Roger's hand, holding it up for all to see.
Ne take any who look upon you in pity. This is a badge of honor. Scars show our defiance of the Alagai, and of Ne herself. They tell her we have looked at the maw of her abyss and spit in it. Asik!
Jardir pointed to the largest of his warriors. At his command, the warrior stood and opened his armored robe, showing a semicircle of tooth marks that covered half his torso.
Clay demon. Big.
Asik spread his arms. Jardir turned to Garrett and narrowed his eyes in challenge.
Not bad. Reckon I got a beat, though.
Garrett pulled a shirt from his muscled chest, turning to reveal a thick line of claw marks running from his right shoulder to his left hip.
Woody got me good. Smaller man might have been cut in half.
Roger watched in wonder as it went around the room like a little ripple, people on both sides of the table standing up to show scars and shouting their stories, arguing over whose were bigger. After the last year in the Hollow, there was hardly a person in town who didn't have at least one. But there was no air of regret in the room. People were roaring with laughter as near misses were recalled and sometimes pantomimed, even the Krasians slapping their knees in delight. Roger looked to Wanda, the girl's face horribly scarred, and saw her smiling for the first time he could recall. When the cacophony was at its highest, Jardir stood upon his bench like a master jongleur.
Let the Alagai see our scars and despair!
Jardir removed his own robe. Muscles rippled along his olive skin, but it was not that which drew amazed gasps from every mouth in the room. It was his scars. They were wards. Hundreds of them, perhaps thousands, cut into his skin like the tattoos of the warded man.
Knight! Maybe he is the Deliverer.
You'd best limp quicker, or you will be left behind in the darkness.
Aban grimaced in pain, sweat running in rivulets down his thick-jowled face. Aman set a brutal pace back to the Krasian camp, and he strode ahead with Ashan, leaving poor Aban stuck between Hasik and Shanjat, two men who had tortured him since childhood and did worse now. Just a week earlier, Hasik had raped one of Aban's daughters when he came to their pavilion to deliver a message. The time before, it was one of his wives. Jaram and Shanjat had made a point of taking Aban's Nisharam's sons under their wing in the Kaji Sharaj, instilling in them such a disgust of their Kafit father that Aban's heart felt torn. All the spears of the Deliverer jeered and spat at him, striking him at their pleasure when the Shah Damakar was not about. They all knew Aman from of old and resented that Aban had the Deliverer's ear as they did not. Aban knew that if he ever fell from Aman's favor, his life would be short indeed. But the moment they left the forbidding generated by the giant ward of Deliverer's Hollow, Aban felt his skin crawling, and he was forced to accept that there was nothing the Sharam could do to him that would make him too prideful to beg their protection in the night. Such was the fate of Kafit.
I do not understand why you treat these Chin weakling as though they were true men.
These people are strong. Even their women have Alagai scars. Think, Ashan. Should I waste warriors conquering these people for Sharak Kar when they fight the Alagai already?
They do not fight under you, Shah Damokar. The Avijah commands that all warriors obey the Deliverer for Sharak Kar to be one.
And so it shall be. But I did not unite the tribes of Krasia by killing men. Unity came from mixing my blood with theirs by marrying their Damating. I see no reason not to do the same in the north.
You would marry that...
That what? That beautiful woman who kills Alagai with a wave of her hand and wards like a sorceress of old? Even the scent of her intoxicates me. I must have her.
She isn't even a vision. She is an infidel.
Even infidels are part of Evrim's plan, my friend. Can you not see it? The only tribe in the north that fights Alagai Sharok is led by a woman, a northern healer blessed with powers never before seen. By marrying her, I can add their strength to our own without a drop of red blood spilled. It is as if Evrim himself has arranged the match. I can feel his will thrumming in me, and it will not be defied.
As the Deliverer wills.
They reached the camp at last, and Amon breathed a sigh of relief when he saw that Amon's pavilion was raised and waiting. The Dal Sharam surrounded it, sleeping in shifts and ever alert for any threat, demon or otherwise.
Amon, meet with me. Shunjat and Ashan, see to the men.
Damaji and Kai Sharam exchanged a bitter look, but they gave no argument and left to comply. A Sikh moved to follow Amon, but Amon stopped him with a look.
I do not require a bodyguard to meet with a Kafit.
When you did not give me another assignment, Deliverer, I assumed my place was with you.
My pavilion could use raising.
A Sikh, see to it.
A Sikh looked up at Amon, murder in his eyes, but Amon, safe behind Amon, gave not the obsequious bow of a Kafit, but a full mocking grin. Amon turned and stepped into the pavilion, holding the tent flap for Amon to enter. The impotent rage on Hasik's face as he closed the flap was poor recompense for his daughter's virginity, but Amon took his revenge where he could find it. Jardir turned to Amon once they were alone.
I apologize for striking you. It was
meant to impress the woman, I know. And it would have been a fair bargain had it worked. But these Chin see the world differently than we do.
Our cultures are a natural insult to each other. I should have known better.
One must take a special care when dealing with Chin.
I am a warrior, Amon. My strategies are for conquering men and killing Alagai. I am not good at the sort of manipulation that you and the Nevera excel at.
Lies have always been vile on your lips, Amon.
So how do I claim this woman? I saw her eyes upon me. Do you think she has the liberty of Damating to choose her husband? Or should I approach her father?
Damating have their liberty because their fathers are not known. Mistress Lisha made a point of introducing us to her father, and then gave you the cloak, a clear sign she is open to courting. An ordinary maiden might give a fine robe to a suitor, but her gift is one worthy of the Deliverer.
So it should only be a matter of arranging a dower with her father.
Ernie is a hard negotiator, but he will be the simple part. I would be more concerned that a Damaja might oppose the match, and the Damaji support her.
I will kill any Damaji who defies me in this, even Ashan.
What message will that send to your army, Amon, when their leader kills his own Damaji for the sake of a Chin woman?
What does it matter? Anevra has no reason to oppose it.
I only suggest it because the Damaja may find she has difficulty dominating this northern woman, as she does your other Jiwasen.
Jardir knew Amon was right. He had always thought Anevra the most powerful woman in the world, but this Lisha of Deliverer's Hollow seemed to rival her in every way. She would not play the role of a lesser wife, and Anevra would tolerate nothing less.
But it is that very indomitability that I must have beside me if I am to lead the Chin to Sharaka. Perhaps I can marry her in secret.
Word of the union would reach the Damaja eventually, and she could cancel it with a word, which Lisha's tribe might take as an unbearable insult.
There is a way. This is Evrim's will. I can feel it.
Perhaps.
Yes?
Only a thought that did not hold water when filled.
What thought?
I had only wondered, what if the Damaja were only your Krasian Jiwaka? If that were so, there might be wisdom to appointing a northern Jiwaka as well, to arrange marriages to Chin in the Greenland.
But not even Kaji ever had two Jiwaka.
Jardir rubbed his fingers together, feeling the smooth scars of the wards cut into his skin as he pondered.
Kaji lived 3,000 years ago, and the sacred texts are incomplete. Who is to say for certain how many Jiwaka he had? You will go tomorrow to the house of Lisha's father to settle your debt and to learn what dower he asks for her.
Aban smiled to the Greenlanders as he limped through the village on his camel-headed crutch. They stared at him, many mistrustful, but while his crutch was an invitation for violence against him in Krasia, it seemed to have the opposite effect among the Chin. They would be ashamed of themselves to hit a man who could not properly defend himself, just as they were ashamed to hit a woman. It explained why their women took such liberties. Aban found he liked the Greenlands more and more as time went by. The weather was neither unbearably hot nor unbearably cold, whereas the desert held both extremes. And there was abundance in the north like nothing Aban had ever dreamed. The possibilities for profit were endless. Already, his wives and children were making a fortune in Everim's bounty, and most of the Greenlands were as yet untapped. In Krasia, he was wealthy, but still only considered half a man. In the north, he could live like a Damaji. Not for the first time, Aban wondered at Aman's true thoughts. Did he truly believe himself the Deliverer, and that such things as marrying this woman were Everim's will? Or was that just a pretense for power? If it were any other man, Aban would have thought the latter, but Aman had always been naively true about such things, and might well harbor such delusions of grandeur. It was ridiculous, of course, but the belief in his divinity shared by almost every man, woman, and child in Krasia gave Aman such tremendous power that it almost didn't matter if it was true or not. Either way, Aban served the most powerful man in the world, and if they had not returned to their old friendship, they had at least fallen into its patterns. The Damaja, and Aban was far too skilled a manipulator not to know another one on sight. Anevera twisted Aman to her own ends, and those ends were opaque even to Aban, who had made fortunes on his ability to see the desires in others' hearts. The Damaja had some unknown power over Aman, but it was tenuous. He was Shar Damaka. Damating or no, if he commanded it, the people would not hesitate to tear her apart to please him. Aban knew better than to come between them, of course. He had survived too long to make so foolish a mistake. The moment Anevera sensed his disloyalty to her, she would crush him like a scorpion beneath her sandal, and not even Aman could stop it. Aban was as far beneath the Damaja as she was below Aman. Farther. The only man who can truly handle a woman is a woman, Aban's father had said to him many times.